Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by the Coriell Institute for Medical Research.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. About 20 years ago, David Williams was attending a church in Ypsilanti, Michigan. And one Sunday, his congregation hosted a community health event to raise awareness among African American men about prostate cancer. The church service wrapped up, healthcare professionals were ready to go, prepared to do blood tests or just provide information.
And I saw an older gentleman who I knew very well. I knew him for more than a decade. And the screening was down in the basement. And I said to him, are you going to go for the screening? And he said, no, he's not going to go because he doesn't want to get AIDS.
David was taken aback. He's a public health researcher. One of his main topics is how race impacts health. He really wanted to convince his friend to participate in this cancer screening.
I said, no, there's no way you're going to get AIDS. He said, yes, they can draw a sample. They might need to draw a sample of blood, and he could get AIDS from the needle.
David insisted the test was safe. There's no way anybody would be accidentally infected.
You know, every needle is sterilized. You can even see that it comes from its own unique package. And he said to me, David, that's what they told you. And if you believe it, that's fine. But I don't believe it.
The older man wasn't worried about an accident. He was afraid the healthcare workers would harm him on purpose.
And I never got to fully understand what were the specific experiences in his background and in his life that led him to be so distrustful.
And skipping that screening test might have cost him his life.
Fast forward many years, he died of prostate cancer. And it was hard for me to attend his funeral. He died of prostate cancer. And he refused to get a screening test that was brought to his local church.
David is at Harvard now, still studying race and health, and he says many African Americans distrust healthcare professionals and researchers.
There's a long history of mistreatment and pain.
So many examples of African Americans and other minorities being misled or harmed by researchers, infecting them with diseases, operating on them against their will. There's the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. David says when trust is lost, it has a ripple effect that can last generations.
Sometimes deeply embedded experiences really shape what people do, even much later in life.
Today's episode is about trust. Trust in science, trust in medical professionals, what happens when it's broken, and what can be done to rebuild it. Our first story is about a disease that could have been mostly wiped out. But it wasn't. It's a story about a public health campaign gone wrong. Sickle cell disease is an inherited blood disorder. Blood cells bend into a sickle shape, which causes blockages and starves tissue of oxygen. This illness affects people of African descent as well as Mediterranean and South Indian peoples. The American government took aim at sickle cell in the 1970s. Jad Slayman reports on how public health missed the mark.
It's March 1972. Bobby Seale is speaking in a crowded gym.
And we are not saying that the survival programs are necessarily revolutionary.
He's the co-founder of the Black Panther Party, a radical African-American civil rights organization founded in California.
But the survival programs are tools and institutions by which we unify our people around.
A banner reads, Sickle Cell Anemia Testing, Black Community Survival Conference. A blood test shows if you have the sickle cell trait or not. Trait carriers usually don't have any symptoms, but if two people who have the trait have children, their kids may develop sickle cell disease, which can be fatal. The Black Panthers had been calling attention to sickle cell for years, and it looked like the government had finally started to listen. Congress had approved a five-fold increase in sickle cell research funding. President Nixon made fighting the disease a priority.
America has long been the wealthiest nation in the world. Now it is time we became the healthiest nation in the world.
Sickle cell testing had been possible for decades. Now there was funding as well as a mandate from the leader of the free world. We were going to stop sickle cell in America once and for all. Only we didn't. This is a young girl in her bed, tears streaming. She's in sickle cell crisis with pain too intense to handle at home.
This pain is very real. My body is on fire.
This is a scene from an amateur documentary shot a few years ago. It's called The Incomplete Cell, and it was made by a father-son team, Robert and Nazir Alston.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, hi Jack, come on in.
I met up with them at their home. Robert is a sickle cell carrier. His son has sickle cell disease. I wanted to know what it's like to live with sickle cell. The first thing you got to know, it hurts. A lot.
Sickle cell pain is kind of like tiny micro razor blades. It's like going at your body. It's like, imagine like razor blades on sandpaper just going back and forth inside your body.
Sickle cell crises occur when sickle-shaped blood cells clump up and block blood flow. They were putting Nazir in the hospital up to 20 times a year, and Robert, his dad, had to watch helplessly.
I wouldn't wish this disease on my worst enemy, because it's so hard as a parent to watch your child struggle with this pain that there is no cure for, and you can't do anything about it. You know, that's very painful. You just have to sit there and just wait till the pain levels go from a 10 to a 2 or 3.
Robert hadn't heard of sickle cell trait until Nazir was born with sickle cell disease in 1998. He wishes he had.
At least it would have opened up a dialogue. You know, when you start dating and say, look, you know, I live with the trait. I was just wondering, you know, do you have the sickle cell trait? You know, because if that person does have the trait, I mean, knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. You just know your carrier status, so does your partner, and the two of you have a talk. It sounds reasonable.
I think, of course, that something ought to be done about this disease, sickle cell anemia.
That's Linus Pauling, a famous chemist, speaking in 1970.
Here you have 1,500 children born a year with this disease and doomed to a pretty poor life.
He's the only person in history to win two unshared Nobel Prizes. His peers thought he probably deserved a third Nobel for his work on sickle cell. He and his team discovered a difference in the chemical structure of sickle cell patients' hemoglobin, essentially what makes sickle cell patients' blood cells form into sickle shapes instead of healthy circles. That was in 1949. In the 50s, he was basically just recommending physicians and parents discuss the disease. But by the 70s, Linus was more extreme, talking essentially eugenics.
We suggest that every young person have his genotype tattooed on his forehead so that young people would recognize at first sight that they were incompatible in this way.
That's laughter. This was also a time when young person, in that context, means young Black person. President Nixon's press release actually described sickle cell as a disease that, quote, strikes only Blacks and no one else. That's not true, by the way.
Because if they marry one another, a quarter of their children will inherit these two genes and will suffer and die.
Newer drugs mean today's sickle cell patients live longer, healthier lives. But back then, it's true, many people were dying quite young. And Linus's biographers tell me he probably didn't actually want carriers to get tattoos. He was joking. But he and other scientists of his era did push for mandatory screening programs. That is, actual laws forcing African Americans to get tested.
And we said this chance, 25% chance of giving birth to a defective child, is too large to allow a combination of ignorance and free enterprise in love to take care of the matter.
He didn't want to leave it to chance, or maybe to choice. Either way, in the 70s, 12 states and D.C. actually passed the sort of laws he had been talking about. The mandates targeted black people by, for instance, only affecting urban areas. It's not clear if Linus or any other scientist's lecture actually swayed lawmakers, but these sort of talks came during a time when people actually listened to scientists. World War II had made them into authorities, saviors even.
The scientists were seen as having made the bomb that stopped the war. And there were also, though, a lot of other things that happened during World War II that made science and medicine seem to have all the solutions to all the problems.
That's Melinda Gromley. She's a medical historian that pieced together a narrative of Linus's work.
People kept thinking, you see in the 60s and other times, people think that the cure to cancer is right around the corner, that a lot of things are going to be solved pretty quickly.
But Melinda explained that what really got Linus on stage was atomic weapons. Most people didn't understand them, but Linus did.
And so he almost immediately, after the bombs were used, started giving talks about how the bombs function.
He spoke at banquet halls, theaters, local chapters of the Elks Club would invite him. He spoke so widely because of deep convictions against nuclear weapons. His second Nobel was the Peace Prize for his work on disarmament. Alongside his nuclear talks, sickle cell would come up as well. For him, both boiled down to human suffering.
There's a lot of human suffering in the individual who has sickle cell anemia, but also the parents who watch their child have a disease and suffer from one of these molecular diseases and then possibly even die from it. So for him, a lot of times it's about the human suffering and how do you decrease the amount of human suffering.
Mandatory screening was applied on a mass scale, but to Linus, it was about individuals in pain, sickle cell patients, their parents, but it all went wrong. I reached out to a physician who specializes in sickle cell, Patricia Cavanaugh, and she says, for one, there was a lot of misinformation.
So imagine you're a mom, your child was screened in school, because that's where one of the places were that they were screening, comes home, has sickle cell trait, she goes to her doctor, her child's doctor, and the doctor says, your child won't live to see her 20th birthday.
Again, that's not true. She's saying people who were sickle cell carriers, who don't actually have symptoms, were often misdiagnosed as having sickle cell disease. Sickle cell is rare. Most people, even a lot of doctors, didn't understand it. And remember Nixon saying sickle cell, quote, strikes blacks and no one else? Coming up with regulations related to people with sickle cell became a sneaky way to actually target African Americans.
There was discrimination in employment, so people were losing their jobs or not being hired because people were afraid that they would hire them and then they would get sick. It ended up backfiring, and it was devastating for many.
So a program intended to help the black community ended up doing the opposite, and there was a complete loss of trust. What was left was fear of doctors, of the government, of science, and there was a gap, 10 to 15 years, without any kind of mass testing. Robert, the father who made the sickle cell film with his son, was born during these gap years, which may be part of the reason he didn't know he was a sickle cell carrier. We have universal newborn screening today, but most trait carriers still don't know they're carriers. Patricia and her colleagues call sickle cell screening a neglected opportunity. She explains why, using the example of Tay-Sachs disease. It's also an inherited disease, and it also affects a minority group, Jews. That screening effort was led by a rabbi from the community level, the exact opposite of the government mandating testing for sickle cell.
Again, when you look at Tay-Sachs disease, you know, there's a 90% reduction in the United States and Canada since the early 70s to today. Sickle cell disease has not changed.
So all that money, all those laws, they didn't move the needle at all. The disease continued through the generations. Today, about 100,000 Americans live with sickle cell disease. You can find the Alston's documentary on YouTube. They made it to get the word out about this disease. It's more home movie than home box office. A father and son with a camera learning as they go. But their effort is in line with what Patricia says was missing in the 70s. Education and community involvement. She says those two elements could have changed the story of sickle cell.
I'm not filming this to make anybody like feel bad for me. It's for a YouTube video so that I could show awareness for other people who have sickle cell like me.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
How have failures and wrongdoings like this impacted African Americans and other minorities and their trust in healthcare and medical research? I talked about that with Harvard public health researcher David Williams.
I'll tell you one of the findings we know from the research on discrimination. People who have experienced discrimination both within the healthcare system, but even if they haven't experienced discrimination within the healthcare system, but in other social institutions in society, they are less likely to follow through on physician's recommendations. So the physician, you've seen him and makes an appointment for you to get this additional screening test, they are less likely to follow through on the test if they've had a history of being treated badly by institutions because they're not sure how well-intentioned this recommendation is. So it is consequential. And I think one of the things that's important within the healthcare context is that providers can work with their patients to build a sense of trust.
And just confirm your allergies.
But how do doctors best do that? What are some things that will build up that trust? That is a broader conversation happening in healthcare right now.
Trust is absolutely fundamental for healthcare.
That's Richard Barron. He is the CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine. They certify doctors. And he also heads the board's foundation, which is devoted to quality issues in healthcare. He says there's concern that trust in healthcare institutions is diminishing. Right now, his organization is hosting a trust challenge, asking providers a simple question.
Tell us about something that you do in your institution that you think builds trust with patients.
Richard told me one of the things that affects trust in doctors is that these days people are getting their health info from the internet, where it's often shared by a friend or family member.
So you're already inclined to believe it and trust it because it's coming from someone you know. Now, that person may be forwarding something completely wrong, completely without basis, maybe forwarding something dangerous. But if it's your uncle, you are inclined, perhaps, to trust it more. And with more and more people getting more and more information from sources like Facebook and Google and Twitter, the healthcare system is going to have to up its game in building trust with patients to be credible as sources of information.
Richard spent 30 years of his life as a family physician, and I wanted to know about some of the things he used to do with patients to create trust. Give me an example. Let's say you have a patient named Bob.
Everything that I would say to Bob, I would be thinking hard, beginning with, does he want to be called Bob or Mr. Jones? We got to get that right at the beginning. And I would want to connect what I was saying to something he cared about. So if I'm trying to get him to control his blood pressure, I'm not going to talk about blood pressure and taking the medicines. I'm going to talk about complications from not controlling blood pressure, like stroke. And I'm not going to talk about stroke until I establish, do you have any friends, do you have any family members who've had a stroke? If the answer to that question is yes, then when we talk about blood pressure, what we're saying is, you probably don't want to be in the situation that that person is in. And the reason we're trying to work on your blood pressure together is to lower the risk that that will happen to you.
Richard says some of the big picture topics in terms of building trust are how hospitals handle mistakes, whether they communicate openly with patients or apologize. But trust is also built one small step at a time.
One of my favorite stories, a colleague had a patient whose last name was spelled S-C-H-I-E-D-L-E. And he managed to trick his electronic health record so that every time the man's name came up, it said underneath it, it spelled it, rhymes with needle. Sheetle rhymes with needle. Everyone in his office who saw this patient with a difficult-to-pronounce name who'd had a lifetime of having it mangled knew that the way he wanted it pronounced was Sheetal. That's something that a healthcare delivery system could do. It would require somebody thinking differently about how to use an electronic health record than people think about today. But we think about things like that as a trust-building practice that really makes a difference, but people need to think about it and organize their work around it.
As somebody whose first name gets mispronounced all the time, Macon, I would totally appreciate that. Richard says, in general, language is also very important, how doctors talk to their patients.
I've often worked with residents and medical students where a patient comes in and says, I have this discomfort in my chest. The resident says, how long have you had your chest pain? Well, actually, doctor, it's discomfort. Okay, does the chest pain get worse when you walk? That interaction right there is a doctor disregarding the language a patient is using and separating themselves from the patient in important ways that make it hard for the patient to trust them.
It even matters if a doctor sits down during an exam.
That communicates, I have time for you, I'm here for you. Standing up feels like, as soon as this is over, I'm heading out the door. It's another thing that tells the patient, signals to the patient, I care.
Richard Barron is the CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine and the board's foundation. They are hosting a trust challenge to find out what healthcare providers are doing to create trust between doctors and patients. We're talking about science and trust, what happens when trust is broken, and how it can be rebuilt. Science is usually an open process. Studies are peer-reviewed and published, but when science is funded by corporations or the government, findings can be classified, proprietary, or secret. So who do you trust to keep those secrets, to do that kind of research? There have been several cases recently where the U.S. government accused Chinese and Chinese-American scientists of stealing secrets. The concern is economic espionage, taking U.S. tech to boost Chinese companies. Many say this has created an atmosphere where scientists of Chinese descent are singled out and falsely accused. Alan Yu has this story.
May 21st of 2015 was a special day for Xiao Xing Xi, a Chinese-American physicist living just outside Philadelphia. He's an expert in superconductors, materials that conduct electricity very efficiently. And he just learned he was promoted and would become the new chair of the physics department at Temple University. His wife was just back from an overseas trip, and his daughter was home from college.
It was kind of a rare occasion for our whole family to be together for a few days.
They went out to a Korean fried chicken restaurant, went to bed late, but soon woke to very loud knocking. FBI agents, with guns pointed, were at the door, ready to break it down with a battering ram. They put Xiao Xing in handcuffs and said he was under arrest. They didn't say what for. They also rounded up Xiao Xing's wife and two daughters. The youngest was 12.
One by one, walked out of their bedroom and hands raised and gun pointed at them. I was telling myself, do everything they asked me to do so that they don't shoot me.
The FBI agents took him to the FBI main office and told him this was all about something called a pocket heater. That's a device that heats chemicals to make a superconducting material. They alleged that after working for a U.S. company, Xiao Xing shared the details of this pocket heater technology with Chinese scientists.
That's absurd. That's literally what I said, the very first word coming out of my mouth.
The accusations didn't make sense for several reasons. This pocket heater technology was no secret. It was invented and patented more than a decade ago by a German professor. And even more baffling, Xiao Xing's research doesn't even use pocket heaters. He had indeed discussed his research with Chinese collaborators, but this isn't unusual. And all of his work is already out there, published in scientific journals. He knew he was innocent, but it would cost months of his life and a lot of money to fix.
I had to tell my daughter and dad I had done nothing wrong. but you need to prepare for a very, very tough life.
He was released on bail for $100,000. Agents searched his home, took away all the electronics. The university put him on administrative leave. For the next few months, he focused on finding a lawyer and working on his case.
We could not sleep well. In particular, my wife had very, very little sleep during those times. I mean, she probably slept an hour or two at best every day. And I couldn't sleep much in the night, too.
He was isolated, couldn't talk to anyone about the case because it might get them in trouble. Finally, 4 months later, the government dropped the charges. I contacted the Department of Justice for a comment, but did not hear back in time for this story. Meanwhile, Xiao Xing's legal fees cost more than $200,000. He's now suing the FBI, saying the government ignored evidence showing he was innocent. Xiao Xing says this is a problem because it casts doubt on legitimate investigations against actual spies.
People would ask, was that another pocket heater?
Another false accusation?
So these kind of things do not help the fight against the economic espionage. It undermines it.
Since 2010, there have been 4 cases in the US where Chinese or Chinese American engineers or defense contractors have actually been convicted in economic espionage cases. There were also cases against 3 scientists where the charges were dropped.
Chinese scientists in the US often find themselves like between a rock and a hard place.
Yang Cheng is a particle physicist at Cornell University. She says the problem is that these scientists from China, most of whom are immigrants, are somehow seen as working on behalf of the Chinese government. And that plays right into Chinese nationalist propaganda. For example, the Chinese government has a program for bringing overseas talent back to China, trying to attract people like her.
On the top of the website, in red, bold font, in Chinese characters, that reads, "The motherland welcomes you, the motherland needs you." And it's a very, very interesting way of phrasing this, that it's not China needs you, China welcomes you, but it's the motherland. The Chinese government regularly invokes this sense of belonging that anybody of Chinese ethnicity, of Chinese origin, is somehow de facto agents of the Chinese state. And this is an authoritarian fantasy. That is not true.
But she says this recent rash of prosecutions suggests some US officials think that it is true.
Then it is actually inadvertently giving credence to the Chinese government's claims of ownership of a people.
This idea of a country having ownership over people and their ideas isn't new. Eugene Chudnovsky is a Russian-American physicist at Lehman College in New York. He says what's happening in the US with Chinese-American scientists reminds him of something that happened to him many years ago during the Cold War, when he was still in the Soviet Union. Eugene was working from home and wasn't clearing his scientific journal articles through the government agency in charge of censorship. A KGB general interrogated him in the early 1980s.
His experts decided that the paper I wanted to publish abroad had to become a state secret. And when I told him that I couldn't know any secrets because I never had any security clearance, he told me that everything that was produced in my head belonged to the Soviet Union. And then he could still send me to prison for that or even apply capital punishment for revealing state secrets.
He says the situation in the US isn't anywhere near as dire. Scientists can still count on independent courts and judges to look at their cases. But the fundamental problem is still there.
Intelligence people don't understand science in general. They don't understand what should really be a secret and what can be just open exchange of information.
Eugene says Congress could fix this by asking the intelligence agencies to consult actual scientists before arresting people.
That's Alan Yu reporting. National interests can impact science, and politics can impact science. What we're interested in as a country, what kind of science is being funded. Historian Audra Wolf says that, in turn, affects trust.
Part of why so many Americans find it difficult to trust scientists is when they make these claims that there are no politics to science, that science is purely objective, because it doesn't take a lot of thought to see that that's not true.
Audra's new book, Freedom's Laboratory, examines the relationship between American scientists and the government during the Cold War. This was a time of fierce competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
In the background was the growing struggle between two great powers to shape the post-war world. Soviet Russia.
Who had the most advanced technology? Which country could score the biggest science achievements? There was a space race and the arms race, and scientists were helping to build the defense industry. Let's say you were writing grant applications, looking for government money in the 60s. How would you best get your grants? What were some of the buzzwords you had to use? Who was looking for what?
When the 1950s and 1960s in particular, if you were a biologist, the best way to get money would be to research the biological effects of atomic radiation. Later, the interest became in fallout. But the general question here was, what damages are we doing both to contemporary generations and to the future when we test atomic weapons? This was a pressing concern, not only because of the fear of what would happen if these weapons would be dropped, but the United States was also very much backing the idea of peaceful uses of atomic energy, whether for nuclear energy or for radio medicine. And so all the researchers involved sincerely needed to have a sense of, is this safe?
Where was nuclear testing happening at the time? How much of it was happening?
So much nuclear testing was happening. It's really hard to imagine from a contemporary perspective. The United States was doing a lot of this in the Pacific, in the Pacific Proving Grounds, small islands, some of which no longer exist because of nuclear testing. The Soviet Union was doing a lot of it in relatively uninhabited areas in its vast territories. France started doing a lot of its testing in North Africa.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and go!
So if research on this kind of safety is funded by the government, the person is doing the research, it turns out this is absolutely not safe. But the government wants to do the tests anyway. I mean, this is where I think as a just regular person, you start questioning, how will your results be interpreted?
Why you should trust somebody who's being paid to research it was absolutely a central question. You know, particularly when we think about atomic weapons and the effects of atomic weapons. Ironically, many of the scientists who were most deeply involved in this work, getting funding to research these topics, these were the same scientists who were involved in disarmament work. So they were the ones who were trying to warn the public that fallout was dangerous. At the same time, they were working very closely with the government. And now there were other kind of grassroots movements that didn't rely on scientific authority, who could say, we could see the damages around this ourselves. There was one study involving baby teeth in St. Louis, where housewives and pediatricians put together their own study to investigate levels of strontium-90 in baby teeth. Because strontium-90 doesn't occur naturally. It's only a byproduct of fallout. And so their working hypothesis was that if you could find strontium-90 in baby teeth, this was clear evidence that fallout was dangerous.
I'm wondering what scientists were grappling with, because if you were working on defense technology, maybe you could think, well, I'm working to defend our country. But maybe you could think, I'm working on technology that could kill millions of people, perhaps even wipe out our planet.
Absolutely. You could think those. But I think for many scientists, many of them were working on pieces a bit more far removed from the actual killing. And this is where this idea of objectivity really comes into play. Many American scientists had convinced themselves that because they had a unique contribution, a unique relationship to knowledge, that they were looking with facts and dealing with facts, that it didn't matter who was funding them or to what end. Then as long as they were being loyal to the facts that were hands and as long as they were asking questions that were driven by their discipline, they were fine. They were fine.
Audra Wolf is the author of Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. We're talking about science and trust, what happens when trust is broken, how it can be rebuilt. When people don't trust science, or a specific kind of science, it affects researchers too and how they feel about what they're studying. Devang Mehta is from India, but he spent 4 years getting his PhD in Switzerland. His topic, helping farmers in developing countries grow genetically modified crops, what we usually call GMOs, that are resistant to disease.
And the plant that I was specifically working on was cassava, which is it's a root crop that's grown mainly in the tropics.
Devang was passionate about the science and its humanitarian potential, but there came a point when he decided to abandon GMOs. Liz Tung has more.
Devang chose his program in Zurich, Switzerland for a reason.
So the lab I joined is actually quite famous in the field of genetic engineering because the professor who was heading the lab just before I joined actually created a GMO called golden rice.
Golden rice is rice that's genetically engineered to contain vitamin A, and it represented the whole reason why Devang wanted to research GMOs. The professor he mentioned, his name is Ingo Patrikas, and he engineered golden rice as a way to fight childhood blindness caused by malnutrition. Malnutrition that kills half of the kids who end up going blind. It was such a big deal that when golden rice first came out, Newsweek put Ingo Patrikas on its cover with the headline, "This rice could save a million kids a year." Devang was super excited to join the lab that landed this discovery. But the people he met in Zurich, at parties, walking around, they didn't share his enthusiasm.
If the topic of my research came up, it would just be met by this really awkward silence because, especially among my generation in Europe, the field of like the label of GMOs has been completely demonized.
There was one incident in particular that stood out to Devang. It was about 2 years into his degree, and he was at a panel talk about GMOs. It was all going well until a protester interrupted, started actually screaming.
You know, she was talking about a friend of hers in the U.S. who had a child with autism, and she seemed to believe that the autism was caused due to the genetically modified corn that is grown in the U.S. and consumed by people living in the U.S.
Devang was stunned. Was this how people viewed his work and by association him?
I did not want her to leave the room or for other people in the audience to think that the product that I was spending 4 years of my life on was actually something that could cause harm to society and to other human beings.
Devang became fixated on trying to explain to people GMO's potential for good, how projects like his genetically engineered cassava could help farmers in developing countries protect their crops from disease. And then, inevitably, he'd get the same question. Why can't farmers just use safer insecticides or organic farming?
Switzerland is one of the richest countries by per capita income in the world. And so it was really hard to communicate to people over there that these are not options in countries like Kenya or India. You know, but GMOs really are, the reason why we work on GMOs is because they are the most effective way to give the farmer a product that he can depend on and not have them rely on chemicals or things that lead to worse outcomes.
Devang says GMOs can be the difference between whether or not farmers are able to feed their families, or in the future, if countries are able to feed their people. So he took it personally when people labeled GMO researchers as,
you know, these kind of hyper-capitalist scientists who are bought by industry and support industry. But that's not who I am.
The problem was GMOs are so controversial that not a lot of people were willing to speak up in their defense. Devang says even other scientists working in related fields like agriculture would avoid talking about them or even make it a special point to say that their technologies were not GMO.
I don't blame them for trying to avoid the topic because the responses can be quite harsh. But I do think that every scientist has a responsibility to stand up for science.
Because Devang says people have all these suspicions about scientists being on the payroll of big corporations, willing to poison the world for a buck. But he says that's just not how science works. Still, he gets why some people are suspicious.
I think there are some legitimate reasons for why people have distrust of science. A lot of this goes back to kind of the way scientists defended big tobacco in the 60s or the use of science in warfare.
Wherever this mistrust was coming from, it was not good news for Daevang's job prospects.
I quickly realized that a lot of researchers were quitting the field just because of, you know, it was difficult to get funding because of the public opposition. It was difficult to do experiments in Europe.
The straw that broke the camel's back came in the form of a paper written by Ingo Patricus, the golden rice inventor who inspired Daevang to come to Zurich in the first place. Ingo's paper talked about his frustration with the fact that more than 10 years after announcing golden rice to the world, it still wasn't being distributed because of pushback from anti-GMO groups like Greenpeace.
I think that really brought home the message to me that this wasn't a field of research that I wanted to spend too much of my future life on, because it was just too difficult to deal with so many different problems while trying to build up a career in science.
By the time Daevang graduated in 2017, he'd made his decision. He was leaving GMO research. He said it was hard leaving something that he'd invested so much time in.
But I'm also kind of relieved that I don't directly have to deal with the pushback anymore.
These days, Daevang researches plant genetics at the University of Alberta, but he says he still speaks up for GMOs when he can. As a scientist, he thinks of it as an obligation.
That's Liz Tung reporting. We've been talking about trust in science and how it's broken, and we've heard about a couple of examples that have shaken our trust, but there's something else that shapes our view of scientists: popular culture, movies, TV shows, books. Distrust in scientists and their work is a recurring theme, and the mad scientist is a favorite villain, like in the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Good and evil are so close as to be chained together in the soul. Man is not truly one, but two.
Or in Superman.
I told you. It's kryptonite, Superman. Little souvenir from the old hometown.
And this one.
Mr. Evil.
Dr. Evil. I didn't spend 6 years in evil medical school to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
The mad scientist is sort of an embodiment of the idea of scientific arrogance and scientific hubris.
Michael Udell is a historian of public health and an ethicist at Drexel University. He says the mad scientist keeps popping up, playing God and crossing boundaries that shouldn't be crossed.
Certainly the longest lasting example, and probably the example that remains the greatest cultural touchstone, is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and the idea that Dr. Victor Frankenstein could reanimate life.
It's alive. It's moving. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
And over the course of time, we've used the name Frankenstein, even though Frankenstein was not the actual monster, to denote some wrongdoing in science, or some perceived wrongdoing in science.
Michael says the mad scientist motif is in part a creation of the writer's imagination, but it also reflects things that people were worried about at the time.
If you look at The Island of Dr. Moreau, for example, which I believe was published in the 1890s, it relates to concerns about vivisection.
That's operating on live animals.
What happened to Mr. Braddock?
Well, those creatures, what are they?
You go back to the compound, that way.
What were they? What were they?
And ideas about evolutionary theory, which were very new to the world, particularly at a time when Darwin's ideas were spreading beyond the scientific domain into the social domain. We see it later in the 1950s and 60s reflecting fears about nuclear technology. And there are some fantastic movies from those times about, you know, killer ants that were exposed to, you know, atomic radiation.
We're born in that swirling inferno of radioactive dust, where things so horrible, so terrifying, so hideous, there is no word to describe them.
And of course, there's the whole canon of Michael Crichton, from the Andromeda Strain to Westworld and Jurassic Park.
Michael Crichton made a career out of examining trust of science. He was constantly exploring this idea of the mad scientist and the way in which, at least in his calculation, scientists would always push past the boundaries of what most society would think of as acceptable science, whether it be bringing back, you know, a satellite from outer space that contained a deadly pathogen, or whether it be recreating dinosaurs.
So how do scientists feel about this trope?
Real scientists get accused of being mad scientists all the time. Craig Venter, who was one of the genomic scientists who first sequenced the human genome and later went on to create the first synthetic life form, has been accused of being a mad scientist. I think that's pretty ridiculous, but you can see where that comes from. It comes from fear and concern over what an individual's work could potentially lead to.
And Michael says we have to be careful not to confuse mad science in movies with bad science in real life.
It relates to bad study design. It relates to the way in which scientists perceive of and treat their study subjects, often unethically. And I think it relates to what scientists always bring to the table, but perhaps bring more of it to the table in the context of bad science, and that is mixing their own personal ideologies with the scientific methodology, which isn't perfect on its own, but those two things mixed together can create real harm.
Michael says there are lots of historic examples of bad science, and science isn't perfect now either.
Sometimes scientists get it right, and sometimes they get it wrong, and we do our best through ethics regulations to help them not get it wrong. But scientists are people too, and that's part of, you know, the practice and evolution of science. I tell my students that, when we look at some of the egregious ethical examples from the history of public health and the history of medicine over the course of the 20th century, that for sure a century from now, people will look back and say, you know, we did certain things wrong, and we harmed peoples and populations in a variety of different ways.
Michael Udell is a historian of public health and an ethicist at Drexel University. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Julian Harris is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. And this week, we had engineering help from Adam Staniszewski. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English is our editorial director. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.